It is Friday, October the 28th. This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, resolving tensions in Syria.
The political implications are very, very complicated because in Syria, northern Syria, you have to deal with the Kurdish situation, the Turks, the Russians. There's so many players involved.
A fight against the Islamic State in Raqqa and Mosul, the U.S. race for president, plus a new film from director Mel Gibson and something new for country music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Russia's ambassador to the United Nations says he is unconvinced by a report linking the Syrian government to the use of chemical weapons in at least three instances. Vitaly Churkin said the report lacked sufficient testimony, material proof, and was full of contradictions.
We believe that the proof is not there for any big punitive action to be taken. It's simply not there. Let's continue the discussion. We'll continue, studying the report. Please read the remarks I made. And they are very, very serious technical remarks, which, bring to light certain weaknesses, let's face it, in the work of GIM. We highly appreciate their attitude to the task they were given. They were given an extremely difficult task to investigate things which happened 2 years ago without even visiting the sites which were involved. They did their best, I suppose.
Virginia Gamba headed the inspection team under the joint auspices of the UN and the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. She defended the investigators' professionalism.
We, myself and my panel, the leadership panel, stand firmly behind our assessments and our conclusions, and I repeated that in Council today.
The United States, the United Kingdom, and France want the Security Council to impose sanctions on the Syrian government for using chemical weapons, but Russia, Syria's closest ally, has repeatedly questioned investigators' conclusions linking chemical weapons to the use of the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. Churkin also said he would welcome a UN investigation into reports of schools being bombed in Syria. And on the bombing, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has called for an investigation into an airstrike this week on a school that killed nearly 30 people, most of them children. Former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who is the UN Special Envoy for Education, also called for a war crimes investigation of the incident. The United Nations says some 2 million Syrian school-aged children are out of school right now, and 52,000 teachers have left their jobs. Since January, there have been up to 40 attacks on schools. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter says he hopes to have the forces ready to begin the assault on Raqqa, the last major Syrian city controlled by the Islamic State, in a matter of weeks. But the U.S. commander for the operation, Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, cautions Raqqa presents unique challenges not present in the ongoing Iraqi offensive to retake Mosul from the Islamic State.
It's going to be with a partnered force rather than the partner being a nation state's armed forces like the Iraqi armed forces. It's going to be our partners, our local partners in northern Syria. It's also going to be done with a lot lighter coalition footprint. We'll have fewer coalition troops there. It's a very complicated battle space. There are a lot of regional security concerns that are in competition there. The Syrian regime's involved. The Russians are involved. Turkey's involved. It's hard. And there's a civil war going on right next door. So it's going to be a tough, very tough political environment and a security environment, I think, for our effort there.
Syria analyst David Lesh of Trinity University tells VOA's Victor Beatty, nearly simultaneous attacks on Raqqa and Mosul make strategic sense.
Just to make sure that those members of the Islamic State that are fleeing Mosul are not able to acquire safe haven in Raqqa. However, yes, I mean, the political implications are very, very complicated because in Syria, northern Syria, you have to deal with the Kurdish situation, the Turks, the Russians. There's so many players involved that you have to basically politically settle the situation before you actually enter into the military equation. For instance, the force that the U.S.-led coalition would most rely on the ground are the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are mostly made up of Kurdish groups and some Arab groups. But these Kurdish groups are at odds with Turkey, and in fact, in a little mini war with Turkish forces. And I think the U.S., you know, has been trying to work with Turkey and to try to settle these matters and differences before any assault on Raqqa is implemented. But a lot of political differences with groups on the ground, with regional players, you know, making sure that the forces are separated from where Russia operates so as to deconflict the area. All of these things in Raqqa have to be settled before engaging in an offensive.
As you indicated, the landscape is so much different from Iraq. In Iraq, you have a central government to deal with, whereas in Syria, you really don't.
The U.S.-led coalition and our allies on the ground would, in fact, be working, in effect, on the same side as the Syrian government and its Iranian and Russian backers. Yet we don't necessarily want to and cannot work with those groups to take on the Islamic State. And particularly, in my mind, the most central feature of this is trying to work out the U.S. relationship with the Kurds in the country of Turkey.
What other groups might also be involved?
Indigenous Syrian Arab forces, Free Syrian Army forces, other groups that have been supported by the U.S., both Kurdish and Arab. You know, by far, the Syrian Democratic Forces, who have been the most effective group fighting the Islamic State on the ground in Syria, are largely made up of YPG elements.
That is David Lesch, a Syria scholar at Trinity University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Among the other stories we're following on VOA, China's Communist Party elevating President Xi Jinping's status to a core leader, plus Ethiopian withdrawals in Somalia raising concern of Al-Shabaab resurgence. Expanded coverage of those stories a lot more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. And now we turn to U.S. politics, where the election to choose the next president is just 11 days away, and the candidates are crisscrossing the nation trying to drum up votes. First Lady Michelle Obama spoke alongside Democratic Party presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, saying America wants a president who takes the job seriously.
I just want to take this moment publicly to thank Hillary. I mean, it takes a level of generosity of spirit to do what Hillary has done in her career, in her life, for our family, for this nation. And if people wonder, yes, Hillary Clinton is my friend. She has been a friend to me, and Barack and Malia and Sasha and Bill and Chelsea have been embracing and supportive from the very day my husband took the oath of office.
Alluding to Clinton's Republican rival Donald Trump, Mrs. Obama said the president needs to have, in her words, the temperament and maturity to do the job well. Clinton also spoke.
Seriously, is there anyone more inspiring than Michelle Obama? And maybe it's especially meaningful to me because I do know something about being First Lady of the United States.
Clinton's husband, Bill Clinton, was president from 1993 until 2001. Mrs. Clinton told the rally there, she spoke to that rally in the state of North Carolina.
I will never forget visiting here with the legendary Maya Angelou, one of the most powerful voices our country has ever heard. So I couldn't think of a better place to come back to with another woman whose voice we need now more than ever.
Maya Angelou, who died in 2014 in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, was an American poet, a memoirist, quite a remarkable lady, a memoirist, that is, and a civil rights activist. Republican Party presidential nominee Donald Trump also out campaigning. He was in Toledo, Ohio.
We want to make America great again, folks. Very simple. 75% of the American people think our country is on the wrong track. Who are the other 25, just out of curiosity? Who are the 25%? We're going to fix it, and we're going to get our country back on the right track.
Trump also took issue, in part, with the way he views Hillary Clinton's tax policy.
Hillary Clinton wants to raise taxes on small businesses up to 45%. What a difference. You know, what a difference this is. And just thinking to myself right now, we should just cancel the election and just give it to Trump, right? What are we even having it for? What are we having it for? Her policies are so bad.
Trump also sent a message to what he called the Washington establishment that a Trump win is inevitable.
If we win on November 8th, Okay, you ready? When we win, there's a lot of good energy in Ohio, that I can tell.
Trump said he would drain the swamp. That was his next comment, that referring to the area around the U.S. Capitol in Washington being built on landfills over what once was a swampy area. He often has remarked during campaign stops that he wants to get rid of the Washington establishment. Real Clear Politics, which compiles a composite of national voter surveys, shows Clinton leading Trump 46% to 40%. If national elections were held today, the actual vote will be on November 8th. Also on that day, all 435 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives will be up for grabs, as well as one-third of the Senate. Across the country, people wanting to be governor of their states will be on the ballots, as well as state legislatures and local offices. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. The word Jerusalem conveys many powerful and often contradictory meanings. It is the birthplace of three major religions and the center of ongoing tension and conflict, yet Jerusalem also is a center of commerce and trade. A landmark exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York explores Jerusalem's many facets, as well as the art of the city inspired during medieval times. VOA's Adam Phillips has our story.
Even by the standards of the Met, Jerusalem, 1,000 to 1,400, Every People Under Heaven, is an ambitious exhibition. It took co-curators Barbara Drake Bame and Melanie Holcomb years of passion, scholarship, and hard work to assemble and put on display.
The idea is really a simple one, even if what it yields is something quite complex, and that is Jerusalem as an inspiration for works of art at a moment when much of the world was possessed with a kind of Jerusalem fever.
Jerusalem is central to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. This one city becomes a nexus for people coming from Africa, from Europe, from much of Asia, from the Indian subcontinent, and of course people also come for reasons of trade.
Indeed, Jerusalem's spiritual magnetism also attracted material wealth. Jewel-encrusted crosses, altarpieces, Stone decorations, pottery, glassware, jewelry, gorgeously illuminated manuscripts, and lots more were on offer to rich and refined patrons from all corners of the known world. Melanie Holcomb.
This is a city where people are coming and going and bumping up against one another.
One image of Jerusalem's ethnic diversity can be gleaned from an illuminated manuscript featured on the cover of the exhibition catalog. It depicts Jesus' entry into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, a week prior to his crucifixion. Baim says the scene from the biblical book of John was a frequent theme in Christian art at the time.
And what makes this image different and noteworthy is the people who are gathered there. We see people wearing turbans, and we see women with head coverings, and we see people with red beards and white beards, and we see young and old and people of different skin colors, clearly including Africans in the population of Jerusalem.
Africa played an important role in Jerusalem's trade. The exhibition opens with a large pile of solid gold coins.
Gold itself was mined in Ghana. Some of the coins are minted in Tunis. Some of them are minted in Cairo. These are coins that just in and of themselves speak to the integration of Africa into the Mediterranean world.
So, for example, there are gorgeous Moroccan textiles on exhibit in the Jerusalem show because Moroccans were an important part of the community there beginning in the 14th century. Ethiopians, on the other hand, say the curators, had been in Jerusalem since the earliest days of Christianity.
The belief is that that link happens through King Solomon, Solomon the Wise, the son of David, had a liaison with Sheba, and that their child is the ancestor of the Christian kings of Ethiopia. The Ethiopian community is, in fact, present in Jerusalem today. They have a fantastic Feast of the Cross in September in Jerusalem, as they do in Ethiopia. And so we represent that community with this very typical processional crosses of bronze that that the Ethiopians use. It involves a lot of cut open work and streamers of cloth.
Medieval Jerusalem also witnessed horrific violence, most notably by Christian crusaders who conquered the city in 1099, plundering its riches and slaughtering thousands of Muslims and Jews. Battles in this holy war are beautifully rendered in some of the exhibit's artworks, which curators Melanie Holcomb and Barbara Drake Baim nevertheless view as propaganda justifying war. On a more festive note, the exhibit also displays a beautiful medieval Haggadah. That's the book Jews use every year in a ritual meal that recounts their liberation from slavery in Egypt. Then, as now, it concludes with the four simple words, "Next year in Jerusalem." That is a yearning that still rings true for millions in our own age. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
And it's time now to see what's trending on social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee here with the latest. Hey, G.
Hi, Steve. One of the top trending hashtags was not something you hear all the time, and it was hashtag Mormon Mafia. A few days ago, Fox News host Lou Dobbs took to Twitter and called an independent presidential candidate, Evan McMullen, is a tool for the quote-unquote Mormon Mafia. And naturally, the internet took that label and ran with it. Dobbs tweeted, "McMullen is nothing but a globalist, Romney and Mormon Mafia tool."
You know, gee, I've got to say, it's quite peculiar to hear Mormon and Mafia in the same sentence.
It's an unusual combo for sure. Here's what other people tweeted. If you keep mocking the hashtag Mormon Mafia, you might wake up in your bed tomorrow next to a basket of muffins. A Mormon woman tweeted that she finds the tweets hilarious and even thanked Lou Dobbs.
And what about McMullen himself? Did he have anything to say about the accusation?
Nothing too serious. He's on Twitter at Evan_McMullen, and he sent out this tweet. The strength of at Team McMullen is that we are the hashtag Mormon Mafia and the Jewish, Catholic, Evangelical, Hindu, Muslim, or no mafia mafias. And he even added an American flag hash flag.
Very good, G. I got you. What else is trending out there?
Just a couple of days ago, I talked to our other host, Lori London, about Icelandic women protesting against wage inequality. And today, we're going to talk about one specific Icelandic woman. Miss Iceland quit pageant after being told to lose weight. Arna John's daughter dropped out of the Miss Grand International contest after the owner of the pageant told her she's too fat. John's daughter doesn't seem to have a Twitter account, but a lot of people are tweeting that she is a brave woman and that they condemn body shaming on such a global level. That's all for me today. Steve?
Many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G. on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Thousands of comic fans arrived at this year's Ulta Mumbai Comic Con convention, swarming the 165 booths showcasing comic artists and their merchandise, which is not just books anymore. Comic sales are rising thanks in part to the worldwide multi-billion-dollar comic movie industry. Artist Cameron Stewart worked for DC and Marvel Comics.
Particularly, again, with the rise of the internet and digital media, there's global markets.
Japan dominating the comic and animation world in Asia, Marvel and DC in North America. But digital comics everywhere are complementing rather than interfering with print comics, opening the door to perhaps more imagination.
The doors are open now. There seems to be a lot more inclusiveness, and comics are changing for the better.
Comics like Priya's Mirror, featuring a female character who is a rape survivor, raising awareness about violence against women. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. A new film from director Mel Gibson tells the story of a World War II Army medic who won the Medal of Honor during one of the war's bloodiest battles. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about Hacksaw Ridge, which stars Andrew Garfield, Vince Vaughn, and Teresa Palmer.
This is a personal gift from the United States government designed to bring death to the enemy.
I'm sorry, Sergeant. I can't touch a gun.
You don't kill?
No, sir.
You know, quite a bit of killing does occur in war.
Private Doss does not believe in violence. Do not look to him to save you on the battlefield.
Desmond Doss was a Seventh-day Adventist who believed that his faith forbade him from harming another human being. Doss had wanted to be a doctor, but when World War II started, he joined the Army. Doss's unit was involved in the Battle of Okinawa in 1945, and it was there that he distinguished himself by saving the lives of 75 of his comrades while risking his own life under enemy fire. Doss continued to do his duty even though he suffered serious injuries during the battle, even refusing treatment so another man could be carried from the field. Desmond Doss was the first conscientious objector to be awarded the Medal of Honor for bravery. Andrew Garfield, who plays Doss in Hacksaw Ridge, says that the real-life hero models a kind of strength that is rarely seen.
What Desmond models, I think, is a new form of strength, a new form of what it is to man up, to be a man. Well, these ideas that I don't think we quite know what they mean anymore. I know for me as a young man becoming, a boy becoming a man a few years ago, I was looking for heroes to model my masculinity on. So I think Desmond's one of those people that we can look to.
Director Mel Gibson said at the film's premiere that Doss's story was one that needed to be told.
You know, toxic masculinity is this whole idea of punching somebody in the nose and winning through might. Might is right kind of thing. It's not necessarily this man goes at it like with love and triumphs. And, he wins the respect of all those around him who thought he was weak and a coward. And he does things that they could never even gotten close to, just the bravery.
Teresa Palmer plays Doss's love interest, Dorothy Schuette, and says the story has the power to touch people.
It's a film with such a profound message. It has the potential to affect positive change in the world. And I just think that it's completely aligned with where Mel's at right now. And he's going to show the world, this is really putting so much of himself out there. He's got a big heart and a beautiful spirit, and I think this film speaks to that.
This is Mel Gibson's first film since Apocalypto in 2006. The director said at the premiere he believes Hacksaw Ridge delivers a great story, even though it did not have the budget of other films.
But the time dictates now that, a film that's not about a guy in spandex, you don't get the budget, you don't get the time. So you have to do what you used to do in half the time with half the money. And I feel like we really got a lot of bang for our buck on this one.
Hacksaw Ridge also stars Vince Vaughn, Sam Worthington, Hugo Weaving, and Mel Gibson's son, Milo. The film is rated R for graphic war violence. It opens in U.S. theaters November 4th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And many thanks to you, Dave. Well, the Grand Ole Opry is going north. The famous venue from country music is branching out of the U.S. state of Tennessee for the first time in its 91-year history with a new restaurant and venue in New York's Times Square. Grand Ole Opry entertainer Carrie Underwood says New York is a strong market for country music. Here's Carrie singing one of her hits performed recently at the Grand Ole Opry. The New York Opry City stage expected to open in April next year. We ought to all go. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zubair Altayeb, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday and enjoy a little more of Carrie Underwood.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The humanitarian and human rights situation in Aleppo is dire. Secretary of State John Kerry described the situation in Syria as one of the largest humanitarian disasters since World War II. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has described Aleppo as a slaughterhouse. The brutal facts, said U.S. Deputy Representative to the United Nations in Geneva, Theodore Allegra, must shock us still further. Over 275,000 people remain trapped in eastern Aleppo. Russia and the Syrian regime's recent assault have killed 400 people, including 100 children, in markets, in bakeries, in schools, at water stations, in mosques, and even in hospitals. Thousands are wounded and cannot access medical care. People are starving and drink contaminated water. The handful of brave doctors and first responders who remain in Aleppo work tirelessly to save lives, even as they face continued assaults. The few remaining hospitals are overwhelmed. People with serious wounds are left on the street in body bags to make room for others who can be treated more quickly. Airstrikes by Russia and the Assad regime are the cause of this devastation, and they are the cause of this suffering, said Deputy Representative Allegra. And let me emphasize, no pause can be a substitute for a genuine end to the violence and full access for humanitarian aid. So Russia and the regime owe the world much more than excuses. Why do they keep hitting hospitals and medical facilities? And why do they keep targeting children and women? These shocking acts in Aleppo, he said, beg for an appropriate investigation, and those who commit them must be held accountable. The United States reiterates its call for an immediate end to all violations and all abuses. Furthermore, the U.S. calls for accountability for those who perpetrate them, especially the egregious, the widespread, and the persistent human rights and humanitarian violations committed by the Assad regime against the Syrian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4 hours.